yesterday was to set up a version of a non-perturbative path integral for gravity using a regularization through these so-called simplicial manifolds or triangulated manifolds. And I explained to you that they're essentially two alternative ways of which one can in which one can use this type of regularization as a basis for the path integral. And the first one went by the name of dynamical triangulation. And in that, you basically chose equilateral, I mean, up to a sign, you chose equilateral building blocks. So they're basically all identical, the building blocks. And you vary the way in which you glue them together in order to create a given four-dimensional piecewise flat and therefore, in general, curved space-time. The other alternative was to, again, look at a similar type of triangulation, but fix the triangulation once and for all, and then let the edge lengths of this triangulation vary, and thereby, of course, creating also different, curvatures in different places, so generically generating different curved space-times there, too. I briefly outlined some of the features of each of the approaches and then went on to concentrate on this formulation of dynamical triangulations and explain to you also that the way this was, the context in which it was used first was in so-called Euclidean quantum gravity. And Euclidean quantum gravity is kind of an a priori, unrelated theory to Lorentzian quantum gravity, that means physical quantum gravity, where you simply substitute kind of the configuration space of all Lorentzian metrics, which is kind of the physical thing, the physical configuration space of Einstein's theory, by a space of four-dimensional Euclidean spaces, so where you don't have a distinction between space and time, and you don't have light rays, you don't have causal structure. So these objects have less structure, if you like. Of course, they still have metric, but the metric is of a different character, and it has a different signature, and of course, it has a whole host of physical implications. Now, the reason this was done is mainly to seemingly simplify the problems from some point of view, and with the hope, I mean, doing it in the Euclidean regime, with the hope of, in the end, being able to interpret it, nevertheless, in terms of Lorentzian quantities, certainly at a macroscopic level. Now, in this dynamical triangulations framework, it's nice in as much, I mean, so it's fully non-perturbative, and one would already expect that it's not actually easy to handle computationally, and that is certainly true in four dimensions. However, in two dimensions, it's still simple enough to actually analytically solve it. At least the pure gravity case, and for this Euclidean business, actually also matter-coupled models have been solved, and they are all related to particular conformal field theories in two dimensions, so about one, which one knows quite a lot, even in terms of continuum theories. So that gives one certainly kind of a point of some confidence that the method as such is valid, because you can also compare to various continuum calculations. And these things, where they can be compared, agree. I then made a little speech to you about the importance of using also, I mean, numerical methods in order to gain information about these non-perturbative systems in higher dimensions. And that at this time, these non-perturbative path integrals, well, we have very few methods to evaluate them in a quantitative way. I mean, it's of course not enough to just write down these formal expressions. You are interested concretely in how these things behave and say how they behave as you remove the regulators you put in, and as they behave as you vary the bare coupling constants you also put in, kind of as an initial input into the construction. And the only way we know how to do this currently is by using Monte Carlo simulations, which is a way to evaluate kind of this big path integral over configurations by what is called importance sampling. So you set up kind of a walk in the path in the space of all configurations, and that walk spends the more time, kind of the more likely the type of configuration is. So ideally speaking, so it gives you a really good idea of what goes on. And of course there are limitations. I mean, any computer has only finite computing capacity, so it of course sets limitations on the size of the systems you can study, which are of a standard nature. I then went on to explaining to you that so people studied these path integrals using dynamical triangulations very, very successfully in two dimensions, and then tried to generalize it to higher dimensions because they saw an obvious application for this for possibly getting out a non-perturbative theory of quantum gravity. However, with the wisdom of hindsight, well, they failed. That became clear after a while. And I started explaining to you how they discovered that they failed. And it was discovered by looking at actually suitable observables. And that observer, one of the observables, which I also mentioned, constructed for you, was a so-called Hausdorff dimension, which simply relates in a given space volumes of geodesic, the volume of geodesic balls to their linear size or radius. So, and these are quantities you can easily measure whenever you have kind of at least distance measurements around in your space, which is certainly true for these triangulations. So one measured these depending this Hausdorff dimension, depending on where one is in which values the bare coupling constant takes, and then I explained to you, well, there were actually two phases that people found, and both are highly degenerate from a geometric point of view. I mean, they're kind of the ground state of geometry. One, the path integral generates for you. They seem to be so singular that they have no interpretation macroscopically in terms of classical geometry. And then one says, well, you know, it was a good try, but unfortunately that doesn't seem to be the correct model of quantum gravity. It's nice in the sense that one has a method. Well, you know, you can point to a clear-cut kind of quantitative criterion that led you to this conclusion. Of course, once you have evidence, you form a certain conjecture on the basis, say, of having measured, you know, this Hausdorff dimension, you can, of course, start thinking what the reason for that is, and then maybe look at other observables and then confirm that what you're looking at has nothing to do really with extended geometry, but is, say, a system of branched polymers, which is interesting in its own right as a dynamical system, you know, in statistical mechanics, but it's not likely to yield anything interesting in terms of giving you a theory of quantum gravity. This attempt failed, but, you know, the good news is that, well, we had a definite way of deciding that it was actually wrong. So, of course, what I'm going to talk about today in the remaining time is a possible resolution, an idea of what might have gone wrong, and what is a potential resolution. Before doing this, I want to draw two general conclusions from the arguments I've been making recently. So the first thing, we can conclude that something, you know, like a dimension, so this Hausdorff dimension is, of course, an example of trying to understand what is the dimensionality of a given space. So this dimension, now in this non-perturbative setting, the way it comes out in the quantum theory is, of course, completely surprising, because who could have thought that it could be anything but 4? Because that was the dimension of the building blocks we put in. Well, so there are mechanisms at play, non-perturbative mechanisms, that make it not at all a foregone conclusion that the dimension that comes out in the end is that of the building blocks you put in the first place. So in a certain way, you can say you are in these non-perturbative models, the kind of the geometric curvature fluctuations you allow, they are so strong, so large, that even the dimension of your space-time can be affected by them, depending on, you know, where, how you choose your bare coupling constants. So dimension, in a way, becomes dynamical. That is very unexpected because, of course, classically, the dimension is something that's fixed, and certainly it's something that's always an integer. So it's a completely new scenario. And it's, here it comes about in a, well, in a very concrete way. So, for instance, in measuring this Hausdorff dimension. And you can, of course, ask yourself, yeah, how does it come about? So that is lessons, kind of general lessons for life, if you're interested in non-perturbative quantum gravity. So now lesson number one was, so in such a non-perturbative framework, where we allow very large curvature fluctuations to happen in at very short scales, dimension can become dynamical. And I write here, it does become dynamical because this type of behavior is generic, as we also see. So, and the second point that kind of follows is that actually to show that a given model of this type has a well-defined classical limit that, of course, includes something like a space-time dimensionality of 4 at large distances is totally non-trivial. Yeah, so let me write this down too. It's non-trivial to dynamically generate extended 4-dimensional, well, you know, I call this quantum geometry, kind of the what the path integral gives you, say. And so these are kind of non-perturbative surprises, which and points which people hadn't really made or were not aware of, certainly not to this extent, because one was simply lacking a kind of the quantitative tools to see, well, what kind of physics comes out of these path integral constructions, okay, beyond making some perturbative arguments which are not valid, which would not never have predicted these phenomena. So it's all due, in a way, the reason why this can come about is that we are in a region where the contributions, I mean, to the path integral, right? Remember our kind of just our former path integral. Let me choose it to be wick-rotated, so it has this form. So there are two types of contribution that generate a certain dynamical outcome in the quantum theory. The weights here, so this is just the action, right? The weight each geometry has, the path, which is this Boltzmann, real Boltzmann weight, and of course, the number of times a given weight is realized geometrically, right? And this is, well, what's hidden in here. So that's kind of your measure. Yeah? And both of these things, they can compete, depending on where you are within your coupling constant space, they can kind of compete to the extent that this plays really very significant, it makes a very significant contribution to the final outcome. And on this, you don't have any good handle, kind of perturbatively. This you can try, you know, to perturb around a given classical solution or what have you, but this tends not, this is not necessarily relevant, and certainly in the case of gravity, it doesn't seem to be, in understanding the full quantum dynamics in a non-perturbative regime. So, in kind of statistical mechanics systems, this is always sometimes called kind of the energy, the competition of energy versus entropy. Entropy is kind of number of microstates, so the number of realizations of a given value of this Boltzmann weight. Okay, and the interplay of these two things brings about your quantum dynamics. So, as I said, people studied this Euclidean model, and after some initial great excitement, the realization set in that it was probably not associated with a good classical theory. And also, just playing around with the ingredients, so, you know, trying to change the action a bit, trying to change, put a different measure into the path integral, actually all led to the same result. So there is what one calls a great degree of universality. That means I can change many details of the explicit regularization, so the explicit details of how you've regularized, as I already mentioned, like choice of building blocks, what precise gluing rules you allow. So to a large extent, these don't influence the final result. And that's in a way nice, because that's something you want, because you don't want the outcome of your theory to depend on an arbitrary regularization procedure you've just, you know, introduced at some stage to make your problem manageable. So ideally, you want all of this to drop out completely. And this goes by the name of universality. And for certain systems with certain properties, you just find that it is satisfied. And of course, in particular cases, you always have to double check that this is actually the case. So, but we now come to, well, the cure. And the cure is to not use the purely Euclidean version of these dynamical triangulations, but use a Lorentzian, or equivalently, what I call a causal implementation of this. And this has also been given the name of causal dynamical triangulations, or CDT for short. So how does one bring back causality in this purely Euclidean picture and still keep it calculable, kind of computable? So a way to do this is as follows: how to encode causality. By causality, you know, I mean the Lyotkin structure of a Lorentzian metric. Lorentzian geometry. So this consists of two things you do. First of all, instead of using Euclidean building blocks, which you can just think of as, you know, suitable chunks cut out of a Euclidean four-dimensional space, flat space, you use Minkowskian building blocks. So where you had in the Euclidean, say, in two dimensions, just for simplicity, in two dimensions. In the Euclidean case, you were working with equilateral triangles. Euclidean. In the Lorentzian or causal case, it turns out handy to work with triangles that have these, as you were also looking at in the exercises, with triangles that have two time-like and one space-like edge. So your task is then to assemble Lorentzian simplicial manifolds from these types of building blocks, all the generalizations in higher dimensions. And of course, what you want to make sure is, of course, this now, you see here, giving you the edge lengths completely fixes the geometry. And in particular, you will know everywhere kind of where, how light rays travel through this, so what the null directions are. And of course, the way you want to glue these things together is you don't want to screw up the light cone structure. So you don't want to have a triangle where the light cone is like this, glued to one where it suddenly then jumps by 90 degrees or something. So you have to glue them together in some kind of consistent way, so that you have a time direction emerging from this. And the way in which one has to do this is to arrange these type of building blocks in kind of slices, kind of sandwiches. I'll make a drawing of this in a second. And these slices are then a natural kind of proper time, discrete proper time parameter that these models possess. So one introduces a notion of proper time and something in addition. And with respect to this time, one forbids certain acausal configurations. And these are called, for reasons that will become apparent in a second, they're called baby universes. Okay. So I just make a drawing for you what this looks like in two dimensions. So in two dimensions, you say, well, you have a two-dimensional Minkowskian signature space-time, a piecewise flat one, and the way we construct those is by having a kind of, if you like, a globally hyperbolic structure where you have a global slicing. Every point, you know, belongs, every vertex of the triangulation belongs to a definite slice, t, t plus 1, t plus 2, etc. Now, here, what you can do is you have arbitrary sequences of up of triangles and upside down triangles of these of the Minkowskian type. So let me just draw an example here. Of a piece of triangulation. Okay, here it is. So I claim this is now a simplicial two-dimensional Lorentzian manifold, and where curvature is situated, of course, in two dimensions, we already know it's situated at the vertices. And as a matter of fact, whenever you look at one of the vertices here, and the coordination number is not 6, then there is non-trivial curvature here. So it's the same as in the Euclidean picture. Of course, here the angles, there will be Lorentzian angles, but the idea is essentially the same. So for instance, if I look here, I have a coordination number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So I definitely have, you know, quite a bit of curvature here. And so, of course, I have also a completely regular tiling of a piece of flat Minkowski spacetime where I just then alternate triangles and upside-down triangles. Okay, so this is a typical piece of Lorentzian spacetime as it emerges, as you use it in this causal dynamical triangulations. Now, what is this issue about the baby universes? Forbidding baby universes is to say that one disallows, let me use another color chalk here, one disallows that this piece, let's imagine, you know, this now continues here for some distance. Let us now imagine that we allow for a piece of the manifold to simply split off as a function of time. So this is now, you know, becomes a little independent branch of my 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time. This is called a baby universe. Yeah? So what does it entail? Imagine, so this is now a surface of constant time. So this is what space is. It's one-dimensional. So I can either choose it to be an open interval, or I can say cyclically identified, then it would be just an S1, right? Now, what I'm saying here is that such a baby universe, the presence of such baby universes, if you allow those, that is the same as allowing spatial topology to change as a function of time. So what was a single interval down here, after I've passed this slice t plus 1, breaks up into two distinct disjoint pieces. So that's what I mean, a topology change of the spatial slice. So that's what one calls, this is what one calls a baby universe. And to kind of forbid those things, well, one needs a time. One needs a notion of time. Because otherwise, the concept is kind of meaningless. So if I drew a continuum picture of this, then it would be to say the typical kind of history we sum over in the CDT path integral, so the typical two-dimensional, one plus one-dimensional history, consists now of geometries that have, you know, this global sliced structure. If I now imagine, you know, I'm drawing, well, I have some, you know, really fine triangulation, so I'm just drawing this in one slice, but just to give you the overall picture, so that's a typical CDT history, and you're suppressing these outgrowths. An alternative picture, if you did allow for them, then you get a completely different picture. Then you have things like this that contribute. And you see, well, if this is now my time, then what I said before, if I cut this at an arbitrary height, usually I will get many components here. 1, 2, 3, 4 in this case. Okay, is that picture clear? And kind of important thing to notice is that if I have, say, if I am in the Lorentzian framework, yes, I have just some, in the continuum, say, some metric g mu nu, so I know where the light cones are, etc., so this has a Lorentzian structure, I allow for some degeneracies, which correspond actually to points like this, now what statement did I want to make? Yes, so I have A, and I've chosen a notion of time, as we've been saying. Then the absence or presence of such baby universes or spatial topology changes is a diffeomorphism invariant statement. So, say, if for one choice of time, you know, such branches are present or absent, whatever is the case, this will also be true for any kind of redefinition of time as is covered by diffeomorphism invariance. So it's a diffeomorphism invariant concept of a Lorentzian geometry to have such baby universe branches. Now, in classical GR, you never consider such histories because, as you can quite easily show, there must be, if you have, for example, a simpler case, so which makes this kind of slightly more transparent, a typical topology changing situation, say in two dimensions, is a trouser topology. So again, time goes this way, and what was initially an S1 boundary now becomes two S1 boundaries. Now, if this is a time direction, one can show there is no Lorentzian metric one can put on this trouser topology that is everywhere well-defined and non-degenerate. And the reason is, kind of geometrically, to convince oneself, you know, what is the physical reason? Well, of course, I have a Lorentzian geometry, so I know what the light cones are everywhere. But you see, here, somewhere here, and of course the light, and there's a time direction, right? So the time direction is always inside the light cone somewhere. But looking at this kind of embedded picture, it's clear that somewhere around here, there must be at least a single point where kind of the tangent to this trouser, now viewed kind of in the three-dimensional space, if you like, for visualization, is horizontal. That also means it cannot possibly be the case, and of course it's spatial, it's purely spatial, the tangent space. And that of course means there cannot be a well-defined light cone in this point. It's just impossible. It's purely spatial. So where's my time direction? So what this means as a minimum is that this G mu nu is degenerate in the sense of the determinant vanishing. So what can happen is that, for instance, that the 0-0 entry just vanishes. But of course, then it doesn't define a good Lorentzian structure. So this point actually introduces an acausality, which just means there not being a well-defined Lorentzian structure in this point. And you might say, oh, well, you know, if I can just reduce it to a singularity in a single point, that is something, you know, very innocent. But it's not allowed, right? It's not allowed by GR. And it's also, it has very funny physical consequences. For example, well, there are two things. So if you just consider that as a classical space-time, you see, imagine you live in this space-time. Now, once you've kind of, say, you go up one of these branches here, at some stage, part of an entire piece of the universe will suddenly become inaccessible to you, namely this other branch. That is called causal discontinuity. So kind of a whole chunk of where suddenly there was a piece of space, whoops, suddenly appears.
Right.
It's not actually something that's observed widely, you know, in macroscopically in our own universe. So that's one thing. Another thing is, when you try and study quantum field theory, just you know, on this two-dimensional trouser space, you find that this is a very, very singular point where you get things like infinite particle production. So it's by no means kind of an innocent, oh, this is just a little point singularity. So certainly, this is not being, it's not a good background geometry, and it's, well, it's just not allowed in classical dynamics at all. Yeah, question?
So does sticking the triangles together so that you keep the light-hand structure, does that prohibit such points of form?
Well, I can do two things. I can, this discussion, in principle, has nothing to do with whether I triangulate the geometry or not. So what you can do, well, you can ask yourself, well, you know, what I've given you are kind of classical arguments. But of course, classical arguments are not valid arguments in general to say what kind of space-times I should be summing over in my path integral. Because in the path integral, they're not classical solutions in any way. And they're not classical configurations. And they're not physical. So it might well be that I have to include histories of this type to get a sensible quantum theory out. A priori, we just don't know. But what we can do, in now a well-defined calculational framework, we can just do one and the other. So we can do, you know, theory one. I allow for such causality violations, and I have baby universe contributions in my path integral, and I just see what is the result, what is the outcome. And then I can do something like this and forbid them explicitly, and then compare notes. I mean, what is the relation between these two theories, and is one more reasonable than the other, you know. So that can be explicitly addressed. And to my knowledge, for the first time, it was addressed in this dynamical triangulations framework. So, and that addresses also an issue I raised. You know, what is the significance of signature, the metric signature in a theory of non-perturbative quantum gravity? Is it just, you know, just sticking factors of I into the right places, or is it something more substantial? Is the difference much more substantial? And what the outcome of this study is, so this is now, I call this a Euclidean dynamical triangulation. So that's a typical configuration you get in the Euclidean one. So here's a topology. It's a product topology. So say an interval in general dimensions. Usually, for simplicity, we choose kind of compact spherical slices. Now, here this is not the case. So here, such spatial topology can change, is allowed to change. So, for instance, you can get then several components, several spherical components, depending on where you are. So, you know, I emphasize a priori, we don't know what is the right prescription for the path integral, which ones of those we should be summing over. So to cut kind of a long story short, and this is kind of how all this game of causal dynamical triangulations got started, it was by realizing that these Euclidean dynamical triangulations clearly gave you the wrong thing in higher dimensions. Although they lead to very interesting and rich models in two dimensions, they give you the wrong thing in higher dimensions, and to say, okay, maybe if I put physically motivated restrictions on the path integral history, I get something completely different. And that is, of course, a conjecture. And then we said, let us try out this conjecture by looking at a simple model, just a two-dimensional toy model of quantum gravity. And let's do the calculation. And, well, to our somewhat surprise, this still is a very kind of interesting and exactly soluble model in two dimensions. But it is totally inequivalent. What comes out here in terms of continuous theory is totally inequivalent to what came out of these models. And there are observables. You can calculate everything very explicitly. All geometric, well, the few geometric observables there are, you can calculate. For instance, you can look at a boundary, and you can look at kind of what is an expectation value of the boundary, things like this. Or you can study what people usually do. They study loop-to-loop amplitudes. So it's simply the propagator of having an in-loop of a certain length and an out-loop of another length. And this can be done both in Euclidean and a Lorentzian framework. And they give rise to totally different results and different critical exponents. So these are kind of truly universal parameters that characterize kind of your continuum theory. So they just come out totally different. Of course, that gave, so for anyone who's interested in the specific argument, that's kind of the article that started all this approach. There is Nuclear Physics B 536 from 1998. So that's when this kind of started. And here I was one of the authors of this original paper. So this is a story obviously close to my heart. Now, of course, then the important question is, now what happens in higher dimensions? And as I already said, we cannot really analytically study these models, but let me just give you, a glimpse of what one does in terms of setup. In four dimensions. And again, kind of you have a kind of sliced structure where, again, you identify kind of the distance between two adjacent constant time slices with kind of a proper time, kind of delta tau equal to 1 in discrete units. So there are two types of building blocks that appear that you use. And the first one is called a 4-1 building block. And it shares four vertices with this lower slice. And maybe I've already drawn this. I forget now. And a single vertex. So this is a complete spatial tetrahedron. Am I drawing this right? Yes, I'm drawing it right. So, and there is up here is a single point. So this is one type of four simplex. And the other type of four simplex shares a single triangle. So three vertices with the lower time slice. And two vertices, that means an edge with the upper slice. And so that's called a 3-2, then for obvious reasons. And you get kind of the whole four simplex by connecting the vertices in this manner. So, of course, geometrically, that it's not as easy to visualize as, you know, fitting two-dimensional Minkowskian triangles into these strips. And also what you need to solve the problem is actually to work out the combinatorics of how many different distinct ways are there of arranging your building blocks, because that gives rise, that means computing the entropy, you know, of a given, say, of a given value of, corresponding to a given value of the action. And solving your path integral in this formalism becomes kind of an accounting problem, so a combinatorial problem. So in other words, if you are able, you just stare at these two types of building blocks, and if you can figure out, you know, a clever way of how to count the different ways in which I can glue these together, kind of even just in a single strip, then essentially you solve the problem of doing the path integral analytically. That is not, you know, you might say that, yeah, maybe this is doable. It's very tricky. It's very tricky. So in two dimensions, completely straightforward. I've wrecked my brain in trying to do it in three dimensions, classify kind of different gluings that is already something I clearly cannot, I haven't been able to do. I'm intrigued to learn that mathematicians actually look at this in three dimensions. So they're, you know, true experts. They're interested in related combinatorial problems, not so much because of, you know, the backgrounds that come from in this special causal context, but they're more thinking of Euclidean structures. But nevertheless, if one can really develop good combinatorial methods to deal with the three-dimensional case, and they're trying this right now. This may very well in some form be applicable. So it's not totally out of the question that at one stage you might be able to do this, but we are not there quite yet. So, and the Einstein-Hilbert action, or the Regge action, after having Vick rotated, has the following form. Well, let me write it in all its glory with all the right constants, but they're really unimportant. So I just want to make kind of a qualitative argument. So consists of three terms, essentially. I'll explain what the symbols mean in a second. Plus n 4, 3, 2, times 5 square root 3 over 2, kappa 0, cosine to the minus 1 of 1 quarter, plus square root 5 over 96 times lambda, plus delta 2 and 4 for 1, plus n 4, 3, 2. So this is a number you have to calculate for in the path integral for every single configuration. So this is what becomes of the Einstein-Hilbert action, you know, curvature term plus cosmological constant term in this particular framework, simplicial framework. So the non-trivial constants that enter here, well, apart from the numerical ones, are kappa naught, and this is essentially, I think it has already appeared, the inverse Bernoulli constant, so it appears here also. That is lambda, just a cosmological constant, and that is a kind of a relative scaling parameter between spatial and time direction. So it's related to this constant alpha here, between time and space. So just in the discretized triangulation between time and space. So it turns out to be handy to leave this as a free parameter. Delta equal to 0 corresponds to alpha being 1. So that means space and time, after I have rotated to the Euclidean, space and time-like edges have identical lengths. So that corresponds, so delta is just a simple redefinition of this alpha parameter that appeared there in the concrete simplicial building blocks. Now, so the crucial thing is, now you put this on the computer and you repeat some of your measurements, that's what we call them, you know, computer experiments, just to understand whether this new path integral behaves any better than the Euclidean counterparts people were studying before. And, you know, what the influence is of making this causal restriction. So, and the way it plays out in higher dimensions is actually very similar to here. Requiring this to happen suppresses these branchings off in the time direction, so suppresses spatial topology changes. So what you find is a phase diagram. So the phase diagram shows you, well, so the first thing that happens is, first one has to fine-tune lambda in order to have a well-defined continuum limit at all. So lambda is just this bare cosmological coupling constant. So this is simply necessary. You have to tune it to a specific critical value. So what remains then to discuss, so you have to put yourself on a two-dimensional submanifold of in the phase diagram. So the phase diagram is spanned by these three parameters, lambda, kappa naught, and delta. And now I'm saying you have to put yourself on a submanifold where this lambda has a specific value already. And then, of course, the remaining phase diagram you have to discuss is two-dimensional. So where interesting continuum limits potentially lie is in this two-dimensional subspace that is only now parameterized by this asymmetry parameter and this kappa naught parameter. And what we find there is a phase diagram with three phases. That means you identify qualitatively different behavior of this path integral depending on where you are with your parameters here. And the phases are called A, B, and C. And they're characterized by very, very different behavior. So if you recall, what I drew for you yesterday was a Euclidean phase diagram. And there I included the lambda, well, anyway, because my blackboard is just two-dimensional, you recall. So it looked like this. This was the Euclidean. Euclidean, and this is here the Lorentzian version. Recall in the Euclidean diagram, this was lambda equal to lambda critical. And we didn't have, because the Euclidean case is purely isotropic, there is no talk about a relative scaling between space and time. Everything is space. So this delta simply doesn't exist. But I also told you that you have to fine-tune to this line here. And then I explained to you that unfortunately there is no interesting classic geometries that lie along this line. So you've got these degenerate cases with a funny house of dimensions. The point here is that I find three phases, two of which I can also basically dismiss straight away as physically uninteresting. Because they essentially, well, they're kind of causal versions of these degeneracies that appeared here. Remember, we had this branch polymer, and this basically corresponds to this phase A. So this is something like, well, this is a counterpart here. This is a counterpart of this phase for the branch polymer. Here we had very tiny, tiny, highly connected universes where everything, you know, was basically connected to a single vertex. So tiny universes of huge volume and small diameter. And this B is essentially an analog of this here. But you see, the beautiful story is that there is now a completely new phase that has disappeared. And in this phase, we actually observe something that appears to have a good classical limit and appears to be an incarnation on large scales of a solution to the classical Einstein equations with a positive cosmological constant of pure gravity, that is. And this is the De Sitter solution. So that is just the well-known, that is just the solution in absence of matter and the presence of a positive cosmological constant. So let me wrap up by briefly explaining to you how we can recognize De Sitter space from this, you know, ensemble of wildly quantum fluctuating path integral histories. So that's a new phase here. New phase with extended geometry. And by this also I mean in particular four-dimensional on large scales. So what I should also emphasize is really that, of course, part of the challenge in now trying to understand, well, what comes out of your computer simulations is interpreting, I mean, what the computer spits out is, of course, just a bunch of, you know, ones and zeros, roughly speaking, to ask specific geometric questions, so to make certain measurements of certain geometric observables, which are well defined in the sense that they are meaningful in this background independent context. And of course, background independent means also we don't have a metric available. We don't have something like a background metric. Maybe, what comes out as a ground state effectively corresponds to a specific metric, but you don't have a coordinate system anywhere. So, for instance, if you told me I'm interested in say the curvature is like at some point x, I don't know what it means to point to a specific x, because that is not meaningful in an ensemble over geometries. Because okay, I take one of the path integral histories and I pick a specific point. Now what does that point have to do with any other point of any other path integral history? So that illustrates a little bit to you that constructing kind of diffeomorphism invariant observables or things that are just well defined in this ensemble of geometries is quite tricky. And there are not so many we know. And they tend to be very, very non-local. So they tend to involve integrations and averages. So a little bit like, you know, what I presented you for the Hausdorff dimension. There were, of course, is quantum averaging going on. You know, I have this experiment like of measuring these geodesic balls, but I have to average over all points and I have to average over all manifolds. Now, this happened to be kind of a meaningful thing I can do. But there are not so many. It's not that, you know, I had a long list of observables ready. So that is a challenge in this type of setup. It has nothing to do with, now, the specific formulations, you know, using whatever triangulated regularization, is a generic issue in non-perturbative quantum gravity. You have no longer a background geometry, which you always have when you do continuum, perturbative continuum calculations. You always know what distance measurements are because you have some background geometry, maybe with some fluctuations, which you then quantify. But you know always, you know what it means, well, you know, to be somewhere in your manifold. So that is no longer the case if you don't have these background structures given to you from the outset. Okay, so that is kind of the ground state. And what we measure, so how we identify this De Sitter space. And, well, the first thing we do is the following. So we look at something we can easily measure is the three-dimensional volume as a function of the proper time for our universes. So the universes, we simulate them for a specific time range, And then we look, what is the volume? The three dimensions. We just count three simplices. So we just count three simplices in these slices. And what we then find is a kind of what you might call a volume profile. So for any given geometry, it looks something like this. A given path integral history. Now, when we take the quantum average over all these volume profiles, so many, 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 and plot kind of the V3, the expectation value of that, this shape is described by a well-known function, and it's a cosine cubed, essentially. And the cosine cubed is exactly the volume profile, so that means kind of time zero is here, not here. So this is symmetric around this maximum. And so the functional behavior of this is essentially a cosine cubed of tau, this parameter, up to some constant rescaling. And the error bus, the fit is amazingly good to this here with some specific amplitude. And what we deduce from this is we identify this with a Euclidean de Sitter space, which in proper time coordinates, so this is a kind of Euclidean de Sitter space, which classically has a line element ds squared equal to d tau squared plus c squared cosine squared tau over c d omega 3 squared, where this here is the volume element on the unit 3 sphere. Okay, so unit 3 sphere. So this is exactly also, of course, topologically the topology of our spatial slices. And this is written in proper time gauge. So you can immediately relate this tau kind of to the continuum version of that tau. And you see, if you now compute the volume, the G, that G, this is essentially what it gives you. It's a cosine for any one of the linear directions. So if I look at the three volume, it's a cosine cubed, like here. So this comes out and just it matches beautifully. And it's the first instance, is of course an indication that indeed, macroscopically, by observing something like the Sitter space, what we can also do is ask for the Hausdorff dimension. And what here, so what is relevant here is kind of the extension. This has a finite extension. That's what we see in the computer simulation. Then we call this capital T. And what we find, that this is the analog in this anisotropic model of measuring the Hausdorff dimension, it's measuring the expectation value of T as a function of the four volume that sits in the total simulation. And this behaves now as is proportional to N4 to the 1/4. So what we do to establish this scaling is we repeat the simulation at many different four volumes, just numbers of four simplices, and then extract this power law behavior. And you see, it's exactly as you would expect from a space where everything scales canonically. So this is like the fourth root of the four volume, and this is, of course, the linear size in the time direction. And similarly, what we find is that this V3 scales like 3/4 of the full volume. So that is an outcome of a measurement. Of course, this has error bars, right? But it's the analog of the measuring of the Hausdorff dimension, and it tells you, indeed, This seems to have macroscopically four-dimensional properties. And is the first instance of what I would call a genuine kind of emergence of something that looks genuinely like a classical space-time from a fully non-perturbative formulation where you've put in no preferred geometry to start with at all. So you've just, all this wild, you're summing over all this completely wild path, very, very singular geometries, kind of the analogs, you know, of the very wiggly path of the non-relativistic particle. And this is what you find. So that, yeah, so that is a kind of spectacular result. But of course, it's only, you know, a piece in the puzzle to say, look, this looks like a really promising approach, because at least it seems to have a good classical limit. Of course, there are many, many more aspects also of the classical limit one has to verify. Is this really gravity? If I put in two masses, can I rederive Newton's law, for example? It turns out to be very, very non-trivial. It's actually a question that has not yet been solved, because we don't really understand what is the appropriate observable that would tell us that in this non-perturbative context. So there are many things to think about. You know, this is kind of a glimpse of where we are on this particular line of research and the type of questions, you know, that come, that pose themselves. Some of them are, which go completely beyond this particular approach. But here, you know, I've tried to illustrate also with some kind of very hands-on concrete prescriptions, you know, how what does one measure in these systems? How does one extract geometric information quantitatively? And these are very beautiful examples that exhibit that. And, you know, that's where we are. And if I come back, you know, talk to further generations of your students, you know, maybe the story will have been pushed further. So this was it, I should say. It's been a pleasure being here. I've interacted with you some, with some more than others. And, well, I'll be back later in the year, so, you know, I'll come and check back up on you. And I'll also be very curious of how you've been doing overall here. And so I wish you all the best and hope to see you again soon.